Codependent No More, Disc 5.
Here's an excerpt from Honoring the Self on self-acceptance. If I can accept that I am who I am, that I feel what I feel, that I have done what I have done, if I can accept it, whether I like all of it or not, then I can accept myself. I can accept my shortcomings, my self-doubts, my poor self-esteem. And when I can accept all that, I have put myself on the side of reality rather than attempting to fight reality. I am no longer twisting my consciousness in knots to maintain delusions about my present condition, and so I clear the road for the first steps of strengthening my self-esteem. So long as we cannot accept the fact of what we are at any given moment of our existence, so long as we cannot permit ourselves fully to be aware of the nature of our choices and actions, cannot admit the truth into our consciousness, we cannot change. It has also been my experience that my higher power seems reluctant to intervene in my circumstances until I accept what he has already given me. Acceptance is not forever. It is for the present moment, but it must be sincere and at gut level. How do we achieve this peaceful state? How do we stare at stark reality without blinking or covering our eyes? How do we accept all the losses, changes, and problems that life and people hurl at us? Not without a little kicking and screaming. We accept things through a 5-step process. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross first identified the stages and this process as the way dying people accept their death, the ultimate loss. She called it the grief process. Since then, mental health professionals have observed people go through these stages whenever they face any loss. The loss could be minor, a $5 bill, not receiving an expected letter. Or it could be significant, the loss of a spouse through divorce or death, the loss of a job. Even positive change brings loss, when we buy a new house and leave the old one, and requires a progression through the following 5 stages. Number 1. Denial. The first stage is denial. This is a state of shock, numbness, panic, and general refusal to accept or acknowledge reality. We do everything and anything to put things back in place or pretend the situation isn't happening. There's much anxiety and fear in this stage. Reactions typical of denial include refusing to believe reality. No, this can't be. Denying or minimizing the importance of the loss. It's no big deal. Denying any feelings about the loss. I don't care. Or mental avoidance. Sleeping, obsessing, compulsive behaviors, and keeping busy. We may feel somewhat detached from ourselves, and our emotional responses may be flat, non-existent, or inappropriate. Laughing when we should be crying. Crying when we should be happy. I'm convinced we do most of our codependent behaviors in this stage. Obsessing, controlling, repressing feelings. I also believe many of our feelings of craziness are connected to this state. We feel crazy because we're lying to ourselves. We feel crazy because we're believing other people's lies. Nothing will help us feel crazy faster than being lied to. Believing lies disrupts the core of our being. The deep instinctive part of us knows the truth, but we're pushing that part away and telling it, "You're wrong, shut up." According to counselor Scott Eggleston, we then decide there's something fundamentally wrong with us for being suspicious, and we label ourselves and our innermost intuitive being as untrustworthy. We're not denying whatever we are denying because we're stupid, stubborn, or deficient. We're not even consciously lying to ourselves. Denial isn't lying, explained Noel Larson, a licensed consulting psychologist. It's not letting yourself know what reality is. Denial is the bugaboo of life. It's like sleeping. We aren't aware of our actions until we've done them. We, on some level, really believe the lies we tell ourselves. There's a reason for that, too. In times of great stress, we shut down our awareness emotionally, sometimes intellectually, and occasionally physically, explained Claudia L. Jewett in Helping Children Cope with Separation and Loss. A built-in mechanism operates to screen out devastating information and to prevent us from being overloaded. Psychologists tell us denial is a conscious or unconscious defense that all of us use to avoid, reduce, or prevent anxiety when we're threatened, Jewett continued. We use it to shut out our awareness of things that would be too disturbing to know. Denial is the shock absorber for the soul. It's an instinctive and natural reaction to pain, loss, and change. It protects us. It wards off the blows of life until we can gather our other coping resources. Number two, anger. When we've quit denying our loss, we move into the next stage, anger. Our anger may be reasonable or unreasonable. We may be justified in venting our wrath, or we may irrationally vent our fury on anything and anyone. We may blame ourselves, God, and everyone around us for what we've lost. Depending on the nature of the loss, we may be a little peeved, somewhat angry, downright furious, or caught in the grips of a soul-shaking rage. This is why setting someone straight, showing someone the light, or confronting a serious problem often does not turn out the way we expect. If we're denying a situation, we won't move directly into acceptance of reality. We'll move into anger. That is also why we need to be careful about major confrontations. The vocation of putting people straight, of tearing off their masks, of forcing them to face the repressed truth, is a highly dangerous and destructive calling, wrote John Powell in Why Am I Afraid to Tell You Who I Am? He cannot live with some realization. In one way or another, he keeps his psychological pieces intact by some form of self-deception. If the psychological pieces come unglued, who will pick them up and put poor Humpty Dumpty human being together again? I have witnessed frightening and violent acts when people finally face a long-denied truth. If we're planning an intervention, we need to seek professional help. Number three, bargaining. After we've calmed down, we attempt to strike a bargain with life, ourselves, another person, or God. If we do such and such, or if someone else does this or that, then we won't have to suffer the loss. We're not attempting to postpone the inevitable. We're attempting to prevent it. Sometimes the deals we negotiate are reasonable and productive. If my spouse and I get counseling, then we won't have to lose our relationship. Sometimes our bargains are absurd. I used to think if I just kept the house cleaner or if I cleaned the refrigerator good enough this time, then my husband wouldn't drink anymore, recalls the wife of an alcoholic. Number four, depression. When we see our bargain has not worked, when we finally become exhausted from our struggle to ward off reality, and when we decide to acknowledge what life has socked to us, we become sad, sometimes terribly depressed. This is the essence of grief, mourning at its fullest. This is what we've been attempting at all costs to avoid. This is the time to cry, and it hurts. This stage of the process begins when we humbly surrender, says Esther Olson, a family counselor who works with the grief or, as she calls it, forgiveness process. It will disappear, she says, only when the process has been worked out and through. Number five, acceptance. This is it. After we have closed our eyes, kicked, screamed, negotiated, and finally felt the pain, we arrive at a state of acceptance. It is not a resigned and hopeless giving up, a sense of what's the use, or I just cannot fight it any longer. Though we hear such statements too, wrote Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. They also indicate the beginning of the end of the struggle, but the latter are not indications of acceptance. Acceptance should not be mistaken for a happy stage. It is almost void of feelings. It is as if the pain had gone, the struggle is over. We are at peace with what is. We are free to stay, free to go on, free to make whatever decisions we need to make. We are free. We have accepted our loss, however minor or significant. It has become an acceptable part of our present circumstances. We're comfortable with it and our lives. We've adjusted and reorganized. Once more, we're comfortable with our present circumstances and ourselves. Not only are we comfortable with our circumstances and the changes we've endured, but we believe we have in some way benefited from our loss or change, even if we cannot fully understand how or why. We have faith that all is well, and we have grown from our experience. We deeply believe our present circumstances, every detail of them, are exactly as they ought to be for the moment. In spite of our fears, feelings, struggles, and confusion, we understand everything is okay, even if we lack insight. We accept what is. We settle down. We stop running, ducking, controlling, and hiding. And we know it is only from this point that we can go forward. This is how people accept things. Besides being called the grief process, Counselor Esther Olson calls it the forgiveness process, the healing process, and the way God works with us. It is not particularly comfortable. In fact, it's awkward and sometimes painful. We may feel like we're falling apart. When the process begins, we usually feel shock and panic. As we go through the stages, we often feel confused, vulnerable, lonely, and isolated. A sense of loss of control is usually present, as is hope, which is sometimes unrealistic. We will probably go through this process for anything that is a fact in our lives that we have not accepted. A codependent person or a chemically dependent person may be in many stages of the grief process for several losses, all during the same time. Denial, depression, bargaining, and anger may all come rushing in. We may not know what we're trying to accept. We may not even know we're struggling to accept a situation. We may simply feel like we've gone crazy. We haven't. Become familiar with this process. The entire process may take place in 30 seconds for a minor loss. It may last years or a lifetime when the loss is significant. Because this is a model, we may not go through the stages exactly as I've outlined them. We may travel back and forth, from anger to denial, from denial to bargaining, from bargaining back to denial. Regardless of the speed and route we travel through these stages, we must travel through them. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross says it is not only a normal process, it's a necessary process, and each stage is necessary. We must ward off the blows of life with denial until we're better prepared to deal with them. We must feel anger and blame until we've gotten them out of our system. We must try to negotiate, and we must cry. We don't necessarily have to let the stages dictate our behaviors, but each of us, for our well-being and ultimate acceptance, needs to spend individually appropriate time in each stage. Judy Hollis quoted Fritz Perls, the father of Gestalt therapy, in this manner, "The only way out is through." We are sturdy beings, but in many ways we are fragile. We can accept change and loss, but this comes at our own pace and in our own way, and only we and God can determine that timing. "Healthy are those who mourn," writes Donald L. Anderson, a minister and psychologist in Better Than Blessed. "Only very recently have we begun to realize that to deny grief is to deny a natural human function, and that such denial sometimes produces dire consequences," he continues. "Grief, like any genuine emotion, is accompanied by certain physical changes and the release of a form of psychic energy. If that energy is not expended in the normal process of grieving, it becomes destructive within the person. Even physical illness can be a penalty for unresolved grief. Any event, any awareness that contains a sense of loss for you can and should be mourned. This doesn't mean a life of incessant sadness. It means being willing to admit to an honest feeling rather than always having to laugh off the pain. It's not only permissible to admit the sadness that accompanies any loss. It's the healthy option. We can give ourselves permission to go through this process when we face loss and change, even minor losses and changes. Be gentle with ourselves. This is a draining, exhausting process. It can deplete our energy and throw us off balance. Watch how we pass through the stages and feel what we need to feel. Talk to people, people who are safe and will provide the comfort, support, and understanding we need. Talk it out. Talk it through. One thing that helps me is thanking God for the loss, for my present circumstances, regardless of how I feel or what I think about them. Another thing that helps many people is the Serenity Prayer. We don't have to act or behave inappropriately, but we need to go through this. Other people do, too. Understanding this process helps us be more supportive to other people, and it gives us the power to decide how we'll behave and what to do to take care of ourselves when we go through it. Learn the art of acceptance. It's a lot of grief. Activity. Number one, are you or is someone in your life going through this grief process for a major loss? Which stage do you think you or that person is in? Number two, review your life and consider the major losses and changes you have gone through. Recall your experiences with the grief process. Write about your feelings as you remember them. Chapter 13. Feel your own feelings. In the words of John Powell, "When I repress my emotions, my stomach keeps score." I used to facilitate groups to help people deal with their feelings, says the wife of an alcoholic. I used to openly express my emotions. Now, after 8 years in this relationship, I couldn't tell you what I was feeling if my life depended on it. As codependents, we frequently lose touch with the emotional part of ourselves. Sometimes we withdraw emotionally to avoid being crushed. Being emotionally vulnerable is dangerous. Hurt becomes piled upon hurt, and no one seems to care. It becomes safer to go away. We become overloaded with pain, so we short-circuit to protect ourselves. We may withdraw emotionally from certain people, people we think may hurt us. We don't trust them, so we hide the emotional part of us when we're around them. Sometimes we feel forced to withdraw our emotions. Family systems, suffering from the effects of alcoholism and other disorders, reject emotional honesty and at times appear to demand dishonesty. Consider our attempts to tell a drunk how we felt about him or her smashing up the car, ruining the birthday party, or throwing up in our bed. Our feelings may provoke unpleasant reactions in others, such as anger. Expressing our feelings may even be dangerous to our physical well-being because they rock the family boat. Even families that have no history of alcoholism reject feelings. "Don't feel that way. That feeling is inappropriate. In fact, don't even feel," may be the message we hear. We quickly learn the lie that our feelings don't count, that our feelings are somehow wrong. Our feelings are not listened to, so we quit listening to them too. It may appear easier at times to not feel. We have so much responsibility because we've taken on so much responsibility for the people around us. We must do what is necessary anyway. Why take the time to feel? What would it change? Sometimes we try to make our feelings disappear because we're afraid of them. To acknowledge how we really feel would demand a decision, action, or change on our part. It would bring us face to face with reality. We would become aware of what we're thinking, what we want, and what we need to do. And we're not ready to do that yet. Codependents are oppressed, depressed, and repressed. Many of us can quickly tell what someone else is feeling, why that person is feeling that way, how long they've felt that way, and what that person is probably going to do because of that feeling. Many of us spend our lives fussing about other people's feelings. We try to fix people's feelings. We try to control other people's feelings. We don't want to hurt people. We don't want to upset them, and we don't want to offend them. We feel so responsible for other people's feelings. Yet, we don't know what we're feeling. If we do, we don't know what to do to fix ourselves. Many of us have abandoned or never taken responsibility for our emotional selves. Just how important are feelings, anyway? Before I answer that question, let me tell you about when I was in treatment for chemical dependency at Willmar State Hospital, Willmar, Minnesota, in 1973. I was faced with kicking a 10-year habit of alcohol, heroin, Dilaudid, morphine, methadone, cocaine, barbiturate, amphetamine, marijuana, and any other substance that even remotely promised to change the way I felt. When I asked my counselor, Ruth Anderson, and other counselors how to do this, they replied, "Deal with your feelings." They also suggested I attend Alcoholics Anonymous. More on that later. I did start dealing with my feelings. It felt terrible at first. I had emotional explosions that I thought would rip the top of my head off. But it worked. I experienced my first days and months of sobriety. Then it came time to leave treatment. I was faced with the unlikely prospect of trying to fit myself into society. I had no resume. It can be difficult for a heroin addict to find and maintain gainful employment. I had to discontinue my relationships with everyone I knew who used chemicals, which was everyone I knew. My family was skeptical about my recovery and still understandably peeved about some of the things I had done. Generally, I had left a trail of destruction and chaos behind me, and I didn't think there was any place in society for me. My life stretched ahead of me, and it held little promise. At the same time, my counselor was telling me to go ahead and start living. Again, I asked her exactly how I should do that. Again, she and others replied, "Keep dealing with your feelings. Go to AA, and everything will be okay." It sounded a bit simplistic to me, but I didn't have much choice. Amazingly, and thanks to the help of a higher power, it's worked so far. I got into deep water with my codependency when I thought myself too sophisticated to deal with feelings. The moral of this story is that dealing with feelings and going to AA can help us recover from chemical dependency. But it goes beyond that, and it answers the question I asked earlier: how important are feelings? Feelings are not the end-all and be-all to living. Feelings must not dictate or control our behaviors, but we can't ignore our feelings either. They won't be ignored. Our feelings are very important. They count. They matter. The emotional part of us is special. If we make feelings go away, if we push them away, we lose an important part of us and our lives. Feelings are our source of joy, as well as sadness, fear, and anger. The emotional part of us is the part that laughs as well as cries. The emotional part of us is the center for giving and receiving the warm glow of love. That part of us lets us feel close to people. That part of us lets us enjoy touch and other sensual feelings. Our feelings are also indicators. When we feel happy, comfortable, warm, and content, we usually know all is well in our world for the present moment. When we feel uncomfortable with anger, fear, or sadness, our feelings are telling us there's a problem. The problem may be inside us, something we're doing or thinking, or it may be external. But something is going wrong. Feelings can be positive motivators, too. Anger can motivate us to solve a bothersome problem. Fear encourages us to run from danger. Repeated hurt and emotional pain tell us to stay away. Our feelings can also provide us with clues to ourselves, our desires, wants, and ambitions. They help us discover ourselves, what we are really thinking. Our emotions also tap into that deep part of us that seeks and knows truth and desires self-preservation, self-enhancement, safety, and goodness. Our emotions are connected to our conscious, cognitive thought process and to that mysterious gift called instinct or intuition. There is, however, a darker side to emotions. Emotional pain hurts. It can hurt so badly we think all we are or ever will be is our emotional part. Pain and sadness can linger. Fear can be a stopper. It can prevent us from doing the things we want and need to do to live our lives. Sometimes we can get stuck in emotions, trapped in a well of a certain dark feeling, and think we'll never get out. Anger can fester into resentments and bitterness and threaten to linger indefinitely. Sadness can turn into depression, almost smothering us. Some of us live with fear for long periods of time. Our feelings can trick us, too. Our emotions can lead us into situations where our heads tell us not to go. Sometimes feelings are like cotton candy. They appear to be more than they actually are. In spite of the darker side of emotions, the painful ones, the ones that linger, and the tricky ones, there is an even bleaker picture if we choose to become unemotional, not feeling our feelings. Withdrawing emotionally and pushing that part of us away can be unpleasant, unhealthy, and self-destructive. Repressing or denying feelings can lead to headaches, stomach disorders, backaches, and generally weakened physical conditions, which can open the door to many illnesses. Repressing feelings, particularly if we're doing it during the denial stage of the grief process, can lead us into trouble with overeating, undereating, alcohol and other drug use, compulsive sexual behaviors, compulsive spending, not sleeping enough, sleeping too much, obsessing controlling gestures, and other compulsive behaviors. Feelings are energy. Repressed feelings block our energy. We don't do our best when we're blocked. Another problem with repressed feelings is they don't go away. They linger, sometimes growing stronger and causing us to do many peculiar things. We have to stay one step ahead of the feeling. We have to stay busy. We have to do something. We don't dare get quiet and peaceful because we might then feel these emotions. And the feeling might squeak out anyway, causing us to do something we never intended to do. Scream at the kids, kick the cat, spill on our favorite dress, or cry at the party. We get stuck in feelings because we're trying to repress them. And like a persistent neighbor, they will not go away until we acknowledge their presence. The big reason for not repressing feelings is that emotional withdrawal causes us to lose our positive feelings. We lose the ability to feel. Sometimes this may be a welcome relief if the pain becomes too great or too constant, but this is not a good plan for living. We may shut down our deep needs, our need to love and be loved, when we shut down our emotions. We may lose our ability to enjoy sex, the human touch. We lose the ability to feel close to people, otherwise known as intimacy. We lose our capacity to enjoy the pleasant things in life. We lose touch with ourselves and our environment. We're no longer in touch with our instincts. We become unaware of what our feelings are telling us and any problems in our environment. We lose the motivating power of feelings. If we aren't feeling, we're probably not examining the thinking that goes with it, and we don't know what ourselves are telling us. And if we don't deal with our feelings, we don't change and we don't grow. We stay stuck. Feelings might not always be a barrel of gladness, but repressing them can be downright miserable. So what's the solution? What do we do with these pesky feelings that seem to be both a burden and a delight? We feel them. We can feel. It's okay to feel our feelings. It's okay for us to have feelings, all of them. It's even okay for men to feel. Feelings are not wrong. They're not inappropriate. We don't need to feel guilty about feelings. Feelings are not acts. Feeling homicidal rage is entirely different from committing homicide. Feelings shouldn't be judged as either good or bad. Feelings are emotional energy. They are not personality traits. People say there are hundreds of different feelings, ranging from peeved to miffed to exuberant to delighted and so on. Some therapists have cut the list to 4: mad, sad, glad, and scared. These are the 4 primary feeling groups, and all the rest are shades and variations. For instance, lonely and down in the dumps would fall in the sad category. Anxiety and nervousness would be variations of the scared theme. Tickled pink and happy would qualify as glad. You can call them whatever you want. The important idea is to feel them. That doesn't mean we have to always be on guard for one feeling or the other. It doesn't mean we have to devote an extraordinary amount of our lives to wallowing in emotional muck. In fact, dealing with our feelings means we can move out of the muck. It means if a feeling, emotional energy, comes our way, we feel it. We take a few moments, acknowledge the sensation, and move on to the next step. We don't censor, we don't block, we don't run from. We don't tell ourselves, don't feel that, something must be wrong with me. We don't pass judgment on ourselves for our feelings. We experience them. We allow the energy to pass through our bodies and we accept it as being our emotional energy, our feeling, we say, okay. Next, we do that mystical thing so many people refer to as dealing with our feelings. We appropriately respond to our emotion. We examine the thoughts that go with it, and we accept them without repression or censorship. Then we decide whether there is a next step. This is where we do our judging. This is where our moral code comes into play. We still don't judge ourselves for having the feeling. We decide what, if anything, we want to do about the feeling and the accompanying thought. We evaluate the situation, then choose a behavior in line with our moral code and our new ideal of self-care. Is there a problem we need to solve? Is our thinking off base? We may need to correct certain disaster-oriented thought patterns, such as, I feel horribly afraid and sad because the car broke down and it's the end of the world. It would be more accurate to say, I feel sad that the car is broken. Is the problem something we can solve? Does it concern another person? Is it necessary or appropriate to discuss the feeling with that person? If so, when? Perhaps it's sufficient to merely feel the emotion and acknowledge the thought. If you're in doubt about what action to take, if the feeling is particularly strong, or if the action you decide to take is radical, I suggest waiting a day or so until you are peaceful and your mind is consistent. In other words, detach. Our feelings don't need to control us. Just because we're angry, we don't have to scream and hit. Just because we're sad or depressed, we don't have to lie in bed all day. Just because we're scared doesn't mean we don't apply for that job. I'm not in any way implying or suggesting we allow our emotions to control our behaviors. In fact, what I am saying is the opposite. If we don't feel our feelings and deal with them responsibly, they will control us. If we're dealing with our emotions responsibly, we submit them to our intellect, our reason, and our moral and behavioral code of ethics. Responding appropriately to our feelings also means we are liable for our feelings. Every person's feelings are his or her own. Nobody makes anyone feel. No one is ultimately responsible for our feelings except us, no matter how much we insist they are. People might help us feel, but they don't make us feel. People also cannot change the way we feel. Only we can do that. Furthermore, we're not responsible for anyone else's feelings. Although we are responsible for choosing to be considerate of people's feelings, responsible people choose to do that at times. However, most codependents choose to overdo that. We need to be considerate of our feelings, too. Our feelings are reactions to life's circumstances. Thus, etiquette requires that when you discuss a feeling with someone, you say, I feel such and such when you do such and such because, not, you made me feel. However, we may want to make another decision about how to deal with our feelings. This is especially true if we're consistently reacting to someone's behavior with a great deal of emotional distress, and even after reporting this distress to the person, he or she continues causing us pain. Maybe you don't need that much help to feel. Remember, feelings are indicators and motivators. Watch for patterns in our feelings. They tell us a great deal about ourselves and our relationships. Sometimes dealing with feelings means a change of thinking is needed. Many therapies acknowledge a direct correlation between what we think and what we feel. There is a connection. What we think influences how we feel. Sometimes inaccurate, overreactive, or inappropriate thought patterns cause our emotions or cause them to remain longer than necessary. If we think something is awful, will never get better, and just shouldn't be, our feelings will be intense. I call this disaster thinking. That's why it's important, after we feel our emotions, to examine our thinking. Get it out in the light. If it's inappropriate, then we know what we have to do to solve our problem, don't we? There are times when we may need to discuss our feelings and thoughts with other people. It's not healthy to live our lives in isolation. Sharing the emotional part of us with others creates closeness and intimacy. Also, being accepted by someone else for being who we are helps us accept ourselves. This is always a marvelous experience. Sometimes we may want to discuss things with a friend who will just listen while we air things and try to figure out what's going on. Things we lock inside can get too big and too powerful. Letting them out in the air makes them smaller. We gain perspective. It's always fun to share the pleasant feelings, too, the joys, the successes, the tickled pinks. And if we want an intimate relationship with someone, we need to discuss our persistent feelings with him or her. It's called emotional honesty. Caution. Intense, happy feelings can be as distracting and scary as intense, sad feelings, especially to codependents who aren't used to happy feelings, according to Scott Eggleston. Many codependents believe happy feelings must always be followed by sad feelings, because that's the way it has usually happened in the past. Some codependents believe we can't, shouldn't, and don't deserve to feel happy. Sometimes we do things to create sad feelings after experiencing happy feelings, or whenever the possibility of a happy feeling exists. It's okay to feel happy. It's okay to feel sad. Let the emotional energy pass through and strive for peace and balance. There are times when we may need professional help to deal with our emotions. If we're stuck in any particular feeling, we should give ourselves what we need. See a counselor, a therapist, a psychoanalyst, or a clergy person. Take care of ourselves. We deserve it. We may also want to seek professional help if we've been repressing feelings for a long period of time, or if we suspect what we've been repressing is intense. Sometimes it just takes only a little practice and awareness to awaken the emotional part of us. The following things help me get in touch with my feelings: physical exercise, writing letters I don't intend to send, talking to people I feel safe with, and spending quiet time in meditation. We need to make awareness of ourselves a habit. We need to pay attention to the shouldn't feel that way attitudes we tell ourselves. We need to pay attention to our level of comfortableness. We need to listen to what we're thinking and saying and the tone of voice we use. We need to keep an eye on what we're doing. We'll find our way to and through our emotions, a way that works for us. We need to invite emotions into our lives, then make a commitment to take gentle, loving care of them. Feel our feelings. Trust our feelings and trust ourselves. We're wiser than we think. Activity. Number one, read through your journal writings. What emotions were squeaking or pouring out as you wrote? Number two, let's play a what-if game. What if you could be feeling anything you wanted right now, and feeling that way wouldn't make you a bad person? What would you be feeling? Write about it. Number three, find someone who is safe, a good listener, accepting, and non-rescuing, and begin honestly and openly discussing your feelings with that person. Listen to that person's feelings without judgment or caretaking gestures. This is nice, isn't it? If you don't know anybody you feel safe doing that with, join a support group. Chapter 14. Anger. "What is it about me that you hate so much?" a man asked his wife 6 months into his sobriety. "Everything," she replied with a glare. For many years, I rarely felt anger. I cried, I felt hurt, but anger? No, not me. After I began my recovery from codependency, I wondered if I would ever not be angry. Janet Woititz described me in this quote from Marriage on the Rocks. "You become rigid and mistrustful. Rage consumes you without a satisfying outlet. Anyone who walks into your house can feel the angry vibrations. There is no escape from it. Whoever thought you would turn into such a self-righteous witch?" Angry feelings are a part of almost everyone's life. Children feel anger, teenagers feel anger, adults feel anger. Sometimes anger plays a small part in our lives and presents no particular problem. We blow off steam and we're done with it. We go on with the business of living and the problem is resolved. That's usually not the case with codependents, particularly if we're involved with an alcoholic, an addict, or someone with a serious ongoing problem. Anger can become a large part of our lives. It can become our lives. The alcoholic is mad, we're mad, the kids are mad, and so is the dog. Everyone is mad all the time. Nobody ever seems to blow off enough steam. Even if we aren't shouting, even if we're trying to pretend we're not angry, we're mad. We give looks and make little gestures that give us away. Hostility lurks just below the surface, waiting for a chance to come out in the open. The anger sometimes explodes like a bomb, but nobody ever gets done with it. The alcoholic says, "How dare you become angry with me? I'm the king. I'll get angry with you, but not the other way around." The codependent says, "After all I've done for you, I'll get angry any time I please." But silently, the codependent wonders, maybe he or she is right. How dare we get angry with the alcoholic? There must be something wrong with us for feeling this way. We deal another blow to our self-worth with a little guilt tacked on. Plus, the anger is still there. The problems don't get resolved. The anger doesn't blow over. It festers and boils. Even with the gift of sobriety or recovery from any ongoing problem, the anger may and usually does linger. Usually, it has reached a peak by the time the alcoholic gets help. Nobody, including the alcoholic, can stand the insanity any longer. Sometimes it gets worse. The codependent may learn for the first time that it isn't the codependent's fault. The codependent may even feel new anger for having believed for so long it was. It may be safe, for the first time, for the codependent to feel and express anger. Things may finally have calmed down enough for the codependent to realize how angry he or she was and is. This can cause more conflicts. The alcoholic may expect and want to start fresh, minus the dirty laundry from the past, now that he or she has begun a new life. So the alcoholic says, "How dare you get angry now? We're starting over." And the codependent replies, "That's what you think. I'm just getting started." Then the codependent may add to his or her low self-worth and guilt another silent, torturing thought. The alcoholic is right. How dare I be angry now? I should be ecstatic. I should be grateful. There's something wrong with me. Then everyone feels guilty because everyone feels angry. And everyone feels angrier because they feel guilty. They feel cheated and mad because sobriety did not bring the joy it had promised. It was not the turning point for living happily ever after. Don't misunderstand. It's better. It's a lot better when people become sober. But sobriety is not a magical cure for anger and relationship problems. The old anger burns away. New anger fuels the fire. The chemical or problem can no longer be blamed, although it frequently still is. The chemicals can no longer be used to medicate the angry feelings. Often, codependents can no longer even get the sympathy and nurturing we need from friends. We think it's wonderful that the alcoholic has quit drinking or the problem has been solved. What's wrong with us, we ask. Can't we forgive and forget? And once more, the codependent wonders, what's wrong with me? Anger may be a commonplace emotion, but it's tough to deal with. Most of us haven't been taught how to deal with anger because people show us how they deal with anger. They don't teach us. And most people show us inappropriate ways to deal with anger because they're not sure either. People may give us good advice. Be angry, but do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger. Don't seek revenge. Many of us can't adhere to these mandates. Some of us think they mean, don't be angry. Many of us aren't sure what we believe about anger. Some of us believe lies about anger. Frequently, codependents and other people believe the following myths about anger. It's not okay to feel angry. Anger is a waste of time and energy. Good, nice people don't feel angry. We shouldn't feel angry when we do. We'll lose control and go crazy if we get angry. People will go away if we get angry with them. Other people should never feel anger toward us. If others get angry with us, we must have done something wrong. If other people are angry with us, we made them feel that way, and we're responsible for fixing their feelings. If we feel angry, someone else made us feel that way, and that person is responsible for fixing our feelings. If we feel angry with someone, the relationship is over, and that person has to go away. If we feel angry with someone, we should punish that person for making us feel angry. If we feel angry with someone, that person has to change what he or she is doing so we don't feel angry anymore. If we feel angry, we have to hit someone or break something. If we feel angry, we have to shout and holler. If we feel angry with someone, it means we don't love that person anymore. If someone feels angry with us, it means that person doesn't love us anymore. Anger is a sinful emotion. It's okay to feel angry only when we can justify our feelings. Many people in programs such as Alcoholics Anonymous believe they should never feel angry in their recovery. The idea intended by recovery programs is that people learn to deal appropriately and immediately with anger before it builds into harmful resentments. As codependents, we may be frightened of our anger and other people's anger. Maybe we believe one or more of the myths, or maybe we're frightened of anger for other reasons. Someone may have hit or abused us when he or she was angry. Some of us may have hit or abused someone else when we felt angry. Sometimes just the raw level of energy that accompanies someone's anger can be frightening, particularly if that person is drunk. We react to anger, both ours and other people's. It's a provocative emotion. It can be contagious. And many of us have so much of it to react to. We have so much of the anger that accompanies grief. We have the anger that comes from the persecution stage of rescuing or caretaking. Many of us are stuck on that corner of the triangle. We have unreasonable anger feelings that may be unjustified and caused by reactive, disastrous thinking. The shoulds, awfuls, nevers, and always. We have justified anger. All the mad feelings anyone would feel if someone did that to him or her. We have the anger that covers up hurt and fear. Sad and scared feelings convert into anger, and many of us have so much hurt and fear. We have anger that comes from feeling guilty. Guilt, both earned and unearned, easily converts into anger. Codependents have a lot of that, too. Believe it or not, so do alcoholics. They're just more adept at converting it into anger. And we have reactive anger. We get angry because the other person feels angry. Then they get angrier, and we get angrier because they got angrier. Soon everybody's angry, and no one's sure why. But we're all mad and feeling guilty about it. Sometimes we prefer to stay angry. It helps us feel less vulnerable and more powerful. It's like a protective shield. If we're angry, we won't feel hurt or scared, at least not noticeably so. Sadly, many of us have had no place to go with all that anger. We swallow it, bite our tongues, stiffen our shoulders, push it into our stomachs, let it rattle around in our heads, run from it, medicate it, or give it a cookie. We blame ourselves, turn anger into depression, put ourselves to bed, hope to die, and get sick because of it. Finally, we ask God to forgive us for being such horrible people for feeling anger in the first place. Many of us have been in a real dilemma with our anger, especially if we're living in a family system that says, don't feel, especially don't feel angry. The alcoholic certainly doesn't want to hear about how mad we feel. He or she probably thinks our anger is unreasonable anyway, and it may bother him or her when we discuss it. Our anger may push the alcoholic's guilt buttons. The alcoholic may even overpower us with his or her anger just to keep us guilty and repressed. Frequently, we can't or don't want to tell our parents how we feel. They may be mad at us for having a friendship with someone who has an alcohol or other drug problem. Or our parents may only see the good side of the alcoholic or addict and think we're unreasonable and unappreciative. Our friends may even become sick of hearing us complain. Some of us may feel so ashamed that we believe we can't tell our pastor or priest how angry we are. The clergy would just call us sinners, and we don't need to hear any more of that. That's all we've been telling ourselves. Many of us wouldn't think of turning to our higher power and expressing how angry we are. So what do we do with all this built-up steam? The same thing we do with almost everything that has to do with us. We repress it and feel guilty about it. Repressed anger, like other repressed emotions, causes problems. Sometimes our anger may leak out inappropriately. We scream at someone we didn't intend to scream at. We wrinkle up our faces, curl our lips, and help people feel like they don't want to be around us. We slam dishes around, even though we can't afford to break anything of material value because we've already lost so much. Other times, our anger may show its face in different ways. We may find ourselves not wanting, unable, or refusing to enjoy sex. We may find ourselves unable to enjoy anything. Then we add more self-hatred to our already heaping pile by wondering what's wrong with us and going on our hostile way. When people ask us what's wrong, we tighten our jaw and say, "Nothing, I feel just fine, thank you." We may even start doing little sneaky mean things or big sneaky mean things to get even with those we're angry at. If anger is repressed long enough, it will ultimately do more than leak out. Unpleasant feelings are like weeds. They don't go away when we ignore them. They grow wild and take over. Our angry feelings may one day come roaring out. We say things we don't mean, or, as usually happens, we may say what we really mean. We may lose control and unleash ourselves in a fighting, spitting, screeching, hair-pulling, dish-breaking rage. Or we may do something to hurt ourselves. Or the anger may harden into bitterness, hatred, contempt, revulsion, or resentment. And we still wonder, what's wrong with me? We can repeat it to ourselves as often as necessary. There's nothing wrong with us. Like the book title says, of course you're angry. Of course we're that angry. We're that steamed because anybody in his or her right mind would be that steamed. An excellent quote from Marriage on the Rocks follows. You cannot live with active alcoholism without being profoundly affected. Any human being who is bombarded with what you've been bombarded with is to be commended for sheer survival. You deserve a medal for the mere fact that you're around to tell the story. Anger is one profound effect of alcoholism. It's also an effect of many of the other compulsive disorders or problems codependents find themselves living with. Even if we're not living with a serious problem or seriously ill person, it's still okay to feel anger when it occurs. Anger is one of the many profound effects life has on us. It's one of our emotions, and we're going to feel it when it comes our way, or else repress it. I don't trust people who never get mad. People either get mad or get even, says my friend Sharon George, who is a professional in the mental health field. We have every right to feel anger. We have every right to feel as angry as we feel. So do other people. But we also have a responsibility, primarily to ourselves, to deal with our anger appropriately. We're back to our original advice. Deal with our feelings. How do we deal with an emotion as potent as anger? How do we quit feeling that angry? When does it happen? Where does it go? Who can we talk to? Who would want to listen to all that? We probably don't even want to hear it ourselves. After all, the person we're mad at does have a disease. So shouldn't we be feeling compassion and all that good stuff? Is it really all right to be this mad at a sick person? Yes, we have the right to be mad at a sick person. We didn't ask for the problem. Although the ideal feeling is compassion, we probably won't feel this until we deal with our anger. Somewhere between homicidal rage and biting our tongue because we feel sorry for that sick person is a way to get past our angry feelings, the old ones and the new ones. But I don't believe dealing with repressed emotions will happen overnight. It may not happen in a month or even a year. How long did it take us to get this angry? Dealing with a significant amount of repressed anger may take time and effort. Dealing with new anger takes practice. Here are some suggestions for dealing with anger. Address any myths we have subscribed to about anger. Give ourselves permission to feel angry when we need to. Give other people permission to feel angry too. Feel the emotion. Even though it's anger, it's only emotional energy. It is not right or wrong. It calls for no judgment. Anger doesn't have to be justified or rationalized. If the energy is there, feel it. Feel any underlying emotions, too, such as hurt or fear. Acknowledge the thoughts that accompany the feeling. Preferably, say these thoughts aloud. Examine the thinking that goes with the feeling. Hold it up to the light. See if there are any flaws in it. Watch for patterns and repetitive situations. We'll learn much about ourselves and our environment. Often, recovering alcoholics develop rancid thought patterns known as stinking thinking that can indicate the desire to start drinking again. Make a responsible decision about what, if any, action we need to take. Figure out what our anger is telling us. Is our anger indicating a problem in us or in our environment that needs attention? Sometimes, while we're asking God to help us stop feeling angry, He's trying to tell us something. Do we need change? Do we need something from somebody else? Much anger comes from unmet needs. One quick way to resolve anger is to stop screaming at the person we're angry with, figure out what we need from that person, and ask him or her for that. If he or she won't or can't give it to us, figure out what we need to do next to take care of ourselves. Don't let anger control us. If we find ourselves being controlled by our angry feelings, we can stop ourselves. We don't have to continue screaming. Don't misinterpret. Sometimes screaming helps. Sometimes, however, it doesn't. It's better if we decide instead of letting our anger decide for us. We don't have to lose control of our actions. It's just energy, not a magical curse over us. Detach. Go to another room. Go to another house. Get peaceful. Then figure out what we need to do. We don't have to let other people's anger control us. I frequently hear codependents say, "I can't do this or that because he or she will get angry." Don't jeopardize our safety, but strive to be free from anger's control, our anger or anyone else's. We don't have to react to anger. It's only emotional energy. We don't even have to react by becoming angry if we don't want to. Try it sometime. Openly and honestly discuss our anger when it's appropriate. But don't talk to a drunk when he's drunk. We can make good decisions about expressing our anger openly and appropriately. Beware of how we approach people, though. Anger frequently begets anger. Instead of venting our rage on the person, we can feel our feelings, think our thoughts, figure out what we need from that person, and then go back to him or her and express that need, instead of hollering. Take responsibility for our anger. We can say, "I feel angry when you do this because," not, "You made me mad." However, I like to give people a little room in communication. We don't always have to say the words exactly right, as if we just walked out of a therapy group. Be ourselves. Just understand we're responsible for our angry feelings, even if they are an appropriate reaction to someone else's inappropriate behavior. Talk to people we trust. Talking about anger and being listened to and accepted really help clear the air. It helps us accept ourselves. Remember, we can't move forward until we accept where we are. And yes, people care. We may have to leave our house to find them or go to Al-Anon meetings, but they are out there. If we have angry feelings that have hardened into resentments, we can talk them out with a clergy person or take a fourth and fifth step. Resentments may be hurting us a lot more than they're helping us. Burn off the anger energy. Clean the kitchen. Play softball. Exercise. Go dancing. Shovel the snow. Rake the yard. Build a condominium if necessary. Anger is extremely stressful, and it helps to physically discharge that energy. Don't beat ourselves or others for feeling angry. Don't let other people hit us or abuse us in any way when they feel angry. Don't hurt other people when we're angry. Seek professional help if abuse has occurred. Write letters we don't intend to send. If we feel guilty about anger, this really helps. Start the letter by asking, "If I could feel angry about anything, nobody would ever know, and it wasn't wrong to feel this way, what I would be angry about is this." Once our anger is out on paper, we can get past the guilt and figure out how to deal with it. If we're suffering from depression, this exercise may help too. Deal with guilt. Get rid of the unearned guilt. Get rid of all of it. Guilt doesn't help. God will forgive us for anything we have done. Besides, I bet he doesn't think we've done as much wrong as we think we have. Once we begin dealing with anger, we may notice we feel angry much of the time. That's common. We're like kids with a new toy. We'll settle down with it. Be patient. We aren't going to deal with it perfectly. No one does. We'll make mistakes, but we'll also learn from them. The reason we're told to not seek revenge is because getting even is a common response to anger. If we've done or do some inappropriate things, deal with earned guilt and go on from there. Strive for progress. We need to be gentle with ourselves if we've been repressing loads of angry feelings. Things take time. We may need to be that angry for now. When we don't need to be angry anymore, we'll quit feeling angry if we want to. If we think we might be stuck in anger, get professional help. Some people believe we never have to become angry if we control our thinking and are appropriately detached. We will never react with or wallow around in anger. That's probably true. However, I prefer to relax and see what happens rather than guard myself rigidly. And like my friend, I'm leery of people who smile and tell me they never get mad. Don't misunderstand. I'm not advising us to hang on to anger or resentments. I don't believe anger should become our focus in life, nor should we look for reasons to become angry to test ourselves. It's not good to be angry all the time, says counselor Esther Olson. It's not healthy to act hostile. There's much more to life than anger. But it's okay to feel anger when we need to. Activity. Number one. What do you think would happen if you started feeling your angry feelings? Number two, what do you believe deep inside about anger? What myths about anger have you subscribed to? If you need to subscribe to new beliefs about anger, do so. Attack the myths whenever they try to attack you. Number three, how do the people in your current family situation deal with anger? How did your mother, father, brothers, and sisters deal with their anger? What's your pattern for dealing with anger? Number four, if you have repressed anger, write about it in your notebook. You may need to buy a new notebook and devote it to anger. Number five, if anger is a troublesome emotion for you, keep a pencil and paper handy and start writing about your anger as it occurs throughout the day. Chapter 15. Yes, you can think. From the second book of Timothy, chapter 1, verse 7. For God hath not given us the spirit of fear, but of power, and of love, and of a sound mind. What do you think I should do? A client who is in the throes of her codependency once asked me. The woman was facing a significant decision regarding her husband and children. What do you think? I asked. You're asking me? She asked. It takes me 15 minutes at the grocery store to decide if I want to buy the 59-cent or the 63-cent bottle of bleach. I can't make the tiniest decisions. How do you expect me to make a big, important one like this? As codependents, many of us don't trust our minds. We truly understand the horror of indecision. The smallest choices, such as what to order at the restaurant or which bottle of bleach to purchase, paralyze us. The larger, significant decisions we face, such as how to solve our problems, what to do with our lives, and who to live with, can overwhelm us. Many of us simply give up and refuse to think about these things. Some of us allow other people or circumstances to make these choices for us. This is a short chapter, but it's an important one. Throughout the book, I've been encouraging you to think about things, figure things out, decide what you need, decide what you want, and decide how to solve your problems. Some of you may be wondering if that's possible. The purpose of this chapter is to tell you that you can think, you can figure things out, and you can make decisions. Good, healthy decisions. For a variety of reasons, we may have lost faith in our ability to think and reason things out, believing lies, lying to ourselves, denial, chaos, Stress, low self-esteem, and a stomach full of repressed emotions may cloud our ability to think. We become confused. That doesn't mean we can't think. Overreacting may impair our mental functioning. Decisiveness is hindered by worrying about what other people think, telling ourselves we have to be perfect, and telling ourselves to hurry. We falsely believe we can't make the wrong choice. We'll never have another chance, and the whole world waits and rises on this particular decision. We don't have to do these things to ourselves. Hating ourselves, telling ourselves we won't make good decisions, and then throwing in a batch of shoulds every time we try to make decisions, doesn't help our thinking process either. Not listening to our needs and wants and telling ourselves that what we desire is wrong cheats us out of the information we need to make good choices. Second-guessing and what-ifs don't help either. We are learning to love, trust, and listen to ourselves. Maybe we've been using our minds inappropriately to worry and obsess, and our minds are tired, abused, and filled with anxious thoughts. We are learning to stop these patterns also. Perhaps we lost faith in our ability to think because people have told us we can't think and make good decisions. Our parents may have directly or indirectly done this when we were children. They may have told us we were stupid. Or they may have made all our decisions for us. Maybe they criticized all our choices. Or they could have confused us by denying or by refusing to acknowledge our ability to think when we pointed out problems in the home. Maybe we had difficulties with subjects in school when we were young. Instead of doing what we needed to do to solve the problem, we gave up and told ourselves we couldn't think and figure things out. People may have put down the intelligence of women, but that's nonsense. We're not stupid. Women can think. Men can think. Children can think. We may be living with people now who are telling us directly or indirectly that we can't think. Some of them may even be telling us we're crazy. But alcoholics do that to people they live with. Maybe we've started wondering if we are crazy. But don't believe any of it for one moment. We can think. Our minds work well. We can figure things out. We can make decisions. We can figure out what we want and need to do and when it's time to do that. And we can make choices that enhance our self-esteem. We're even entitled to opinions. And yes, we do have some of those. We can think appropriately and rationally. We even have the power to evaluate ourselves and our thoughts so we can correct our thinking when it becomes disastrous or irrational. We can evaluate our behavior. We can make decisions about what we need and want. We can figure out what our problems are and what we need to do to solve them. We can make little decisions and big decisions. We may feel frustrated when we try to make decisions or solve problems, but that's normal. Sometimes we need to become frustrated to make a breakthrough in our thinking. It's all part of the process. Remember, decisions don't have to be made perfectly. We don't have to be perfect. We don't even have to be nearly perfect. We can just be who we are. We can make mistakes in our choices. We're not so fragile we can't handle making a mistake. It's no big deal. It's part of living. We can learn from our mistakes, or we can simply make another decision. The following quotation discusses decisiveness in the corporate world, but I believe it applies to other areas of life too. If you make a decision, you'll become a hero within the corporate culture. If 30% of your decisions are right, you're going to be a big hitter. We can even change our minds, then change them again, then again. Codependents vacillate. As codependents, we're in the midst of upsetting situations. We may go back and forth a lot. We may throw the alcoholic out, then take him or her back. We may leave, then come back, then leave again. This is how we get to where we're going. It's okay. Let's take it one step further. It's normal and often necessary. But, a codependent may object, you don't know my mind. Sometimes I think terrible thoughts. Sometimes I have unspeakable fantasies. We all do. And it's normal, especially if we're living with an alcoholic. We may have attended an alcoholic spouse's funeral 100 times in our minds. Our thoughts are keys to our feelings. Our feelings are keys to our thoughts. We don't have to repress. We need to let the thoughts and feelings pass through, then figure out what we need to do to take care of ourselves. The following suggestions may help us gain confidence in our mental abilities. Treat our minds to some peace. Detach. Get calm. If we're facing a decision, big or small, get peaceful first, then decide. Wait until our minds are consistent. If we absolutely can't make a decision on a particular day, then it's obviously not time to make that decision. When it is time, we'll be able to do it. And do it well. Ask God to help us think. Every morning I ask Him to give me the right thought, word, or action. I ask Him to send His inspiration and guidance. I ask Him to help me solve my problems. I believe He does help. I know He does. But He expects me to do my part and think. Some days go better than others.